All right, continuing on with the first chapter of the letter of Revelation. I, John, your brother, who share with you and Jesus the persecution and the kingdom and the patient endurance, was on the island called Patmos because of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet saying, "Write in a book what you see and send it to the seven churches: to Ephesus, to Smyrna, to Pergamum, to Thyatira, to Sardis, to Philadelphia, to Laodicea." Then I turned to see whose voice it was that spoke to me, and on turning I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the midst of the lampstands I saw one like the Son of Man, clothed with a long robe and a golden sash across his chest. His head and his hair were white as wool, white as snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire, his feet like burnished bronze, refined as in a furnace. His voice was like the sound of many waters. In his right hand he held seven stars, and from his mouth came a sharp, two-edged sword. His face was like the sun shining with full force. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead, but he placed his right hand on me and said, "Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last and the living one. I was dead, and see, I am alive forever and ever. I have the keys to death and Hades. Now write what you have seen, what is and what is to take place. As for the mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand and the seven golden lampstands, the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches." Friends, this is the word of the Lord. There's this great scene in a movie that came out a year after I was born called Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And throughout the movie, Bill and Ted, who are these really like chill bro surfer types who always say like "excellent" to one another, they end up on this excellent adventure, and you follow them through this excellent adventure, and they in one great scene take with them these figures from history: Abraham Lincoln and Genghis Khan and Joan of Arc and Beethoven. And they take them to, of all places, a shopping mall. And as you can imagine, these figures from the past are a little bit overwhelmed at all that the American shopping mall experience has to provide them. Beethoven plays a solo on an electric keyboard. Joan of Arc leads an exercise class. Genghis Khan can't stop messing around with sports equipment because it looks like, you know, tools for battle. And Abraham Lincoln keeps trying to convince people that he's actually Abraham Lincoln. And the scene, it's really funny, but it came to my mind this week because it's also a reminder that what is normal and everyday and assumed to us in the modern world may seem out of place, if not crazy, to someone from a different culture or a different time in history. More than any other book in the Bible, I think Revelation is like that scene from Bill and Ted, and I could even see it in your eyes as I read about golden lampstands and fire and sashes and white as wool. You're kind of a little bit like, what's going on here? When we open this book, it's like we modern creatures jump in a time machine to the first century, and we're walking around and we're confused at everything that we see. Maybe there's no other book as scary or as underread or as underappreciated or as misunderstood as the book of Revelation. And my guess is that if you do your morning devotionals once in a while, you don't sit down by the fireplace or outside and just say, "I wonder what the middle of Revelation's got to say to me this morning." And if you do, that's great. Let's talk. I think that we have a trouble with this wonderful letter for three reasons. And I want to go through those reasons because I think it's going to help us. We're going to have to do a little bit of back historical work to help us to get to hear what John is trying to say to this church that in some ways is extremely different and far from us, in some ways is really similar and caught up in the same circumstances that we are. We don't understand Revelation in part because we don't know what kind of a thing it is. We don't know its genre. For instance, all of us know instinctively that a poem gets its meaning across in a different way than does a text message, than does a work of nonfiction, than does a film or an art installation or an emoji or a snap or a tweet. Right? The medium that we use to communicate something says something about the meaning that we get out of it. The medium means meaning. The genre of something determines how we access what it's actually trying to say. And we do this without thinking in our world. And in the case of Revelation, we've been committing a 2,000-year-old mistake that Revelation is this scary book about the end of the world and fire and brimstone and predicting the future, or about something called the rapture, where God, who apparently is loving, is also going to magically whisk away a percentage of the population who is faithful while leaving behind another. That was kind of the popular image of Revelation when I grew up. I remember seeing the Left Behind books on my Kirk Cameron, oddly, a guy from that fun TV show, was really into this way of thinking about Revelation. But there again, we're like Genghis Khan in a sporting goods store in a mall in 1989. It just doesn't match, doesn't fit. Revelation, quite simply, is a letter. It's a letter that somebody wrote to churches in a very particular place, in a very particular time, in Asia Minor in the first century, so what is now modern-day Turkey. And it's written in a medium, in a genre that is so unfamiliar to us. It's called apocalyptic. And I joked with Barry saying that I wouldn't make you say this, but I'm going to make you say it. Say the word apocalyptic. Yeah, it doesn't exactly just smooth off the tongue, right? Maybe you're hearing that word apocalyptic, a word that we do sometimes use or know, the word apocalypse. It conjures images from Will Smith's movie Independence Day, like the end of the world, or like, you know, Avengers Endgame or something, like everything is coming to an end. But in the original language that Meredith was just talking about, in Greek, the word apocalypse, it literally just means to uncover or to unveil or to reveal something true. To uncover or reveal or unveil something true. It's like in the movie The Wizard of Oz, when they finally arrive and see the great and powerful Oz, and he's this big green monster on the screen, and then you realize that he's actually just this grumpy old man behind the curtain, and you see what's really been going on all along. Or for you Gen Zers out there who don't watch The Wizard of Oz, it's like in Hawkins in The Stranger Things, when there's something going on underneath it all, and you see it finally in season one and season two. You see that something else has been going on, and you need to reveal it and uncover it to see the truth of what's actually happening. And that's quite simply what this letter is. It's a letter written to reveal to a particular people in difficult circumstances what God is up to behind the scenes. I think the second reason that we have a hard time with this letter is quite simply because its imagery feels kind of unbelievable and foreign and just strange, right? It's a book about angels and demons and lampstands and beasts and lakes of fire and earthquakes. It's like an ancient sci-fi thriller meets abstract art installation. And again, with our modern minds and our memes and our movies and our social media, almost all of the imagery used in this book just doesn't quite compute. But all of the imagery in this book would have been understandable and recognizable to its first century listeners. It's like if I was writing a letter to you, Salisbury, First Presbyterian Church in Salisbury, in the 21st century, and I mentioned offhandedly the Cheerwine Festival, immediately you would think of the trucks and the food and the terrible parking situation and the loud noise and the Cheerwine just flowing through the streets, right? But an ancient person would have no idea. That's what Revelation does. In almost every single page of Revelation, there's an allusion to the Old Testament or to something happening in the ancient world. And without those pieces, we're kind of lost, we're kind of blind and walking through the dark. And the last reason, quite simply, is that we don't understand what was happening in first century Rome and the place where these Christians were particularly living, their circumstances. And that's where I want to go next. I want you to do something with me. I want you to put on your imagination cap for a moment and jump into a time machine with me to the first century and to see what it would have felt like to be a first century Christian. It's around the year 95, and Emperor Domitian, a powerful leader, sits atop Rome's throne. But Rome, as a nation, are far from unified. In fact, there have become cracks in Rome's democracy, and it feels as though politics are as polarized as they've ever been. They've had 3 emperors in 2 years, and small factions have started to form in the name and support of particular political figures. What is true and what is not feels difficult for people to discern. Rome is also undergoing a period of economic instability because of the threat of war more globally. Wealthy classes grow wealthier and poorer classes grow poorer, and there appears to be an ever-disappearing middle class in Rome. The earth also poses a threat to human flourishing at this moment because of the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. Smoke is literally in the air, and the threat of natural disasters looms large in the ancient mind. In the early days of Christianity, after Jesus had died and rose again, there was this power and fire for the gospel. It was felt like it was just going to spread like wildfire. But now, almost all of Jesus' 12 disciples, they're gone. They've been killed. They've been martyred for their faith. Peter, the rock of the church, is dead. The Apostle Paul, the famous letter writer of the New Testament, has been killed in Rome. Only a few remain, and some who remain are hiding. The once growing, fiery faith of Christianity is now faltering and simmering, and it feels as if it could die within a generation. One Christian, imagine with me, named James, he's just converted. Just converted to Christianity, and his trade was that of a farmer. And every spring, he attends a Roman festival where he and his other farmers pledge allegiance to the gods of Rome, the gods of rain and weather, so that their crops might be good in the coming year. But now, James believes in the one God of Israel. And he heard that just last week, one of his friends refused to bow down to the gods of Rome. And he found his farm burned to the ground the next day, and he's disappeared. Soon, James will be pulled before the Roman magistrates and asked to curse Jesus Christ. And if he does, his name will be put on a list of those to not receive persecution. If he refuses to curse Christ, he could be bullied, likely lose his job, his farm, his family will lose an income, or worse, he'll be tortured and killed. Under the reign of Emperor Domitian, the emperor cult, the worship of the human leader, the emperor, has come again. In 3 of the cities that John wrote this letter of Revelation to, there are temples arisen from the ground where they worship Caesar. And in the eyes of this emperor religion, Caesar is not just a human leader. And listen for the words that they use to describe Caesar. Caesar was proclaimed as Son of God, the Prince of Peace, the bringer of good news, the bearer of the gospel, the Lord of all creation. Any of those words sound familiar? Christians could be forced to utter the words in Greek, Kyrios Kaiseros, Caesar is Lord, rather than Kyrios Christos, Christ is Lord. And that's the tension that they lived within. To not call the emperor Lord was not only unpatriotic, it was treasonous. So the question facing this small group of churches in the Roman Empire is, what does it look like to live out your Christian faith amidst a volatile and uncertain world? 2,000 years may separate us. Is that not the question that we ask? The question that grounds our existence? You know, we may not be a church experiencing persecution for our faith. There are churches in the world that experience that, like modern-day China, Christians in Iran and Afghanistan. We find ourselves comfortably worshiping on Sunday morning. But we do know what it's like to be Christians in chaotic times. We know political uncertainty. We know a mental health crisis for our young people. We know addictions. We know the poor are still among us and seem to be increasing. We know the church isn't as big as it once was. We know in our own lives, very personally, disappointment and fear and shame and loss and grief. You know those things because you brought them with you this morning in your body, in your memory. And this is precisely why this weird and off-putting letter written 2,000 years ago might just be written for you, for us, this morning. John looks out at this ever-spinning world, and he chooses to do something that is so hard to find these days. He offers a word of hope rather than despair. He offers a word of comfort rather than cynicism. He reminds us that there's something within Christianity buried deep down, a sturdy, stubborn seed, a small fire that's impossible to extinguish, that has allowed the faith to endure in people through whatever life has brought for 2,000 years. And the source of that fire, way down to its core, where it burns the hottest, is not the courage of individuals. It's been the God who is alive. The one who says, "Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last. I was there when you took your first breath, and I will be there to receive you when you take your last. I was dead, but see, I am alive forever." Friends, God is alive. God holds all that we are and have been in God's hands. And despite all evidence to the contrary, God is speaking to us and through us now. And God holds our lives. God holds this church in God's hands, no matter what. And that is true for you, no matter what the world throws at you. T.S. Eliot, a great poet, once said that Christ is the still point of our ever-turning world. And that does not change. It's fashionable in today's church ministry world to believe that if we're just savvy enough, if we just find the right silver bullet, we will make Americans want to come to church again. Right? We'll make these worship spaces as full as they were in our memory. The key to unlocking the First Presbyterian megachurch is just one good idea or new pastor or new church initiative away. But sometimes I wonder of myself and I wonder of others if we've forgotten the main thing. That ever since the first century until now, the people of God have quite simply been defined as bearers of God's story of love, as carriers of the good news of the gospel, who with their hands and feet and voice have proclaimed God's grace for people who don't deserve grace and forgiveness for the unforgivable. Bearers of God's love, that's simply John's advice for the first century Christians in Rome. There's a movie that encapsulates this for me. It's called To End All Wars. It's a beautiful gospel movie, and it's about Irish soldiers who are prisoners of war in a Japanese internment camp during World War II. And there in that camp, these Irish soldiers, they encounter the worst parts of humanity. They encounter the brutalities of war, of no food, of being beaten, of the kind of hate that you can't even imagine. They're given every reason to hate their enemies, the Japanese, more and more. In one striking scene, a truck full of wounded Japanese soldiers arrives at the door of the camp. The Japanese commander calls them dogs for being wounded and for leaving the field of battle and tells them that they must leave before they receive medical attention. One Irish soldier, after moments of silence, begins to walk toward the truck. His hardened Irish general remarks, "Captain Gordon, I forbid you to comfort the enemy." And the man responds, "These are wounded, dying human beings." And slowly but surely, the wounded and starving Irish prisoners begin to comfort and care their wounded enemy. And you can see that this Irish general and this Japanese general, they cannot comprehend what is happening before them. To love those persecute you. Despite the worst circumstances, these soldiers believed what John preached, that they had been set free and loved, that they had been forgiven, and that forgiveness and grace gave them the audacity to love even the most unlovable in their midst, even their enemy. This is the image John gives for us in his letter. He says, you are to be a kingdom of priests. It's an image from the book of Exodus. What does a priest do? It doesn't mean you got to go and get ordained like me and Laura. Your ordination happens in that font. Once you are baptized, you are ordained in a ministry of Jesus Christ. A priest is a reflection, a mediator, a shade, a mirror of who God is and what God is like. That's our job. To be priests, to reflect the goodness and grace of God in the world. God has chosen the broken, wounded, faltering vessel called the church, full of a ragtag group of mess-ups like you and me, people with plenty of issues who have a lot going on in this crazy world, to be the emissaries of God's grace and love in the world. The world needs priests no matter what's happening in the world. The gospel, it's not just something we hear. This letter of Revelation, it's not just something spoken to us. It's something we become. You are God's love letter to the world. Now, as I look out at the world, it does seem crazier than ever. And institutional religion sure seems to be fighting an uphill battle. And maybe your life feels like one disaster and mishap and mess up after another. But that's the way of life. And that is the way of faith. We fight, we press on, nevertheless, we love, nevertheless, for the one who is and was and is to come has set us free to live out the gospel. I have no idea what the future holds. I wish I had a crystal ball and I could tell you what the church will be like, what the world will be like in 15, in 20, in 30 years. But I don't. No more than John didn't have a crystal ball to know what the world would be like for those Christians 20, 30, 40 years in the future. Only God can reveal that to us in time as we live day by day. What I do know, though, is that this way of being priests, will be one excellent adventure. And I hope, I pray, that you will choose to come along. In the name of the one who was and is to come. Amen.